speaker this afternoon is Chris Howe, who's local, and he's going to talk about phylogenetics of medieval plants.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, and thank you to the organisers for the invitation to talk at this. In the words of Monty Python's Flying Circus, and now for something completely different, but actually not that different. We've heard a lot in the last couple of days about how one can use phylogenetic methods to analyse data such as DNA sequences, amino acid sequences, and so on. But actually, there are a number of other sets of data that develop in a very similar way by propagation with the incorporation of changes which are in turn propagated. And I'm sure many of you, for example, will be familiar with work by Russell Gray and others applying phylogenetic techniques to the evolution of languages. And this is a very impressive language evolution tree that that he published some time ago. Now, in my lab, as well as more kind of conventional, respectable phylogenetic analysis, we're interested in applying techniques from molecular genetics to the study of manuscripts. And in two particular areas, the one I'm going to concentrate on today is applying computer programs from phylogenetics to try to infer the copying history of sets of manuscripts. So we're dealing with written traditions here rather than with linguistics. Essentially, one's trying to answer the question of a set of extant versions of a manuscript, which of these versions were copied from the same earlier version. And this is a field of study that's referred to as stematology and was in fact pioneered by the German textual scholar Lachmann back in the mid-19th century, interestingly around the same time as Darwin's ideas on evolution were developing. And I'll say a little bit about work that we started doing, studying not the text on the manuscript, but actually the manuscript itself. This is just a nice picture of a particularly important manuscript that I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. This is a thing called the Hengut manuscript and is a copy of the Canterbury Tales by Chaucer and is a particularly important copy. So obviously we have this image of manuscripts copied by a series of scribes. Why might we want to understand the copying history? What is the role of stematology? Well, it may tell us more about the history of the manuscripts themselves. If you have two versions of a manuscript which were copied from the same ancestor, then it may well be that they were copied in the same place. It may also tell us something about the history of variants, changes in the text, and why they were introduced, because not all the changes that we're dealing with were accidental changes. There are deliberate changes too. And one may want to, although this is no longer very fashionable, one may want to try to get a better idea of the original text that we're dealing with. So I think you can see, if we look at this picture of a scribe, one often has this image of scribes as being monks working in a monastery, but actually that's very often far from the case. Many scribes are actually civil servants. So this is a very nice picture of Jean Millot, who was a high-ranking civil servant under the Duke of Burgundy. And you can see he's copying his text up here and making a copy down there. And the analogy to DNA replication, where we have DNA polymerase and we end up with two identical or nearly identical daughter molecules, I think is quite clear. And the analogy, well, it's clear to me anyway. The analogies are quite striking. The people who make DNA polymerase, for example, for polymerase chain reactions, here's a picture from one of their catalogues, make a big fuss about the accuracy of the enzyme, the proofreading capacities of the enzyme, as shown here. Interestingly, on the right is a picture of a medieval manuscript, and scribes, when they'd copied manuscripts, would proofread them, and to prove how carefully they'd proofread it, they would put corrections in the margin, and they would put little decorations around the corrections to emphasize how carefully and how much effort they'd put into proofreading. Indeed, I've seen a lovely manuscript that actually has one of these things in a little box with a little pulley on the top, and there's a picture of a scribe down at the bottom who's pulling on a string and pulling this correction up into the place in the margin. So in principle, what we want to do is to use differences between versions of a text that have accumulated as those versions were copied to infer the phylogenetic history of that text. And in principle, this is how we do it. We might have an original text, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. This is an English nursery rhyme. I gather there isn't an equivalent in many other languages, so it may seem like complete gibberish to many of you. but there is sense in it. And this might have been copied to give this version Humpty Dumpty sat on a table, or this version Humpty Dumpty stood by the door. That version is now lost, but was copied, and we have a version there, Humpty Dumpty lay by the door, and Mr. Dumpty stood by the door. So these are the extant texts that we have. And we go through exactly the same procedures as we're used to in phylogenetic analysis. We align them, and typically we will take one word as one column or character, and we can encode those to produce a nexus file, exactly the same kind of file that we're used to in phylogenetic analysis. And we can then, for example, use that to construct, in this case, a distance matrix, and use the familiar methods from phylogenetics to reconstruct the copying history of that set of texts. So some time ago, we became interested in trying to apply these methods to sets of manuscripts. And we got together with Peter Robinson, who's a manuscript scholar who's been interested for a very long time, and worked with Andreas Dress as well and others, interested in trying to construct manuscript histories in this way. And we picked the Canterbury Tales to work with initially. This is a set of tales told by pilgrims on the way to Canterbury, which was invented by Geoffrey Chaucer. That exists in about 80 different manuscript versions. And we started out, because Peter had the data available, looking at the prologue to The Wife of Bath's Tale, which exists in about 58 different 15th century versions. This is The Wife of Bath on her horse here. This is a picture out of a book in the university library up the road. She was a very interesting lady, as you can see by the whip that she's carrying as she goes along. So we basically take these texts. In this case, in this first analysis, we put them through a splits tree analysis. And this is a figure that we published some time ago. And this is the result that we get. All these numbers, all these letters here represent extant manuscripts. Indeed, I'll mention that in a moment. Yeah. So what's very encouraging is that if you compare the results that we get from the splits tree analysis with the conclusions from people who've studied the Canterbury Tales for decades, there is a great deal of consistency. The real scholars had identified different groups of texts, which they called A, B, C, D, and so on, and O for others. And what I've done here is I've colored the different texts according to their groups. So what we can see is that the groups that they recover, like group B, for example, we recover very consistently in the splits tree analysis. As Andreas pointed out, this manuscript, Hengert, is very close to, it's an unrooted tree, but is very close to this kind of star here. And indeed, the manuscript scholars had other reasons to believe that the Hengert manuscript was very very close to Chaucer's original, and the Hengert scribe knew Chaucer and worked with him. In fact, there's an extremely funny story about this, because Chaucer wrote a poem to his scribe in which he told him off for being such a bad scribe and making lots of mistakes. And he called his scribe Adam. And people in English faculties around the world have written PhD theses on how Adam in this poem represented humanity and so on. And a friend of mine, Lynn Mooney, has actually managed to unmask the scribe, and it turned out his name is Adam. His name is Adam Pinkhurst, and that's why Chaucer addressed him as Adam in his poem, not because he was representative of mankind. But, but there you are. It's a nice story. So anyhow, when we published this, a lot of the manuscript scholars didn't like this kind of approach. They thought it was a bit vulgar. So we were very keen to try to test this approach with other sets of manuscripts. And we got together...
Where is the
Huntington Garden manuscript? The
Ellesmere. Yeah.
I'm coming on to that. That's actually not shown there, but for reasons... Ellesmere I'll come on to in a moment. So we took a set of historical poems called The Kings of England Since William the Conqueror, which is a set of verses about British kings, 35 extant manuscripts and a few early printed copies. And we got our colleague Lynn Mooney, who's a manuscript expert, to analyse these using the kind of conventional approach and to group them in the way that she thought was accurate, using historical information as well as the textual information. And then we compared her results with results that we got using a phylogenetic analysis completely independently of her. So Lynn identified four groups, if you like, of the manuscripts, A, B, C, and then others that were difficult to classify. Our tree, this just gives you an idea of the kind of change. So this relates to William the Conqueror, William I in 1066. One version says, buried at Cannes, thus saith the chronicler. Another one, buried at Cannes, and thus saith the chronicler. Those are the kinds of change that you're looking at. So this is a parsimony analysis of the tradition. I won't go into the details of how it's constructed, but again, what I've done is I've coloured Lynn's groups the same colour. So her group A is coloured in red and is down here. Her group B is in blue over there, and her group C is in brown and over there. And there's actually remarkably good correlation between the groups that Lynn had found by conventional approach and our phylogenetic analysis. These two are a little bit worrying over here. These are from a couple of manuscripts in the Oxford Library, but in fact, talking to Lynn, it turned out that she was uncertain as to where they should go anyway, so we're not too bothered about that. So there is quite good correlation between the conclusions of our kinds of studies and the conclusions that the real manuscript scholars come to, except that we can reach these conclusions very, very rapidly once we have the data encoded, because we have computer-based methods, whereas the manuscript scholars do everything on the back of an envelope and so on, and it takes a very long time. Now, of course, as Tandu told us the other day, not everything in evolution is that simple, and indeed not everything in paleography is that simple as well. Because if we go back to our picture of our scribe, then we'll see that actually he's not only got one book there, but he's got another book there, and he's using two different books to make his copy. And this is an example of something that the manuscript scholars have known about for a long time, called contamination, where a scribe used more than one copy, or exemplar they call them, to make their text. And of course, this comes in two varieties. Successive contamination, which is shown here, where the text changes abruptly at a particular point, and simultaneous or incidental contamination, where you get a kind of patchwork. And clearly this kind of textual phenomenon is very closely similar to genetic recombination or lateral gene transfer, depending on what particular system you're looking at. And we know, for example, that bacteria are efficient at lateral gene transfer. So we've been interested to try to see how well we can study the effects, particularly of successive contamination, using these phylogenetic approaches. And what you would expect in the case of successive contamination is that if you construct trees from different parts of the text, say the first quarter and the last quarter, you would get a different set of results. And that's exactly what we find. Here's a tree, again, it's a more complicated tree, but again, it's the Wife of Bath prologue. And the two details to look at are this one, which is the Hengert manuscript, and this one down here, which is the Ellesmere manuscript, which is one that Andreas was asking about. And you can see in this tree, which is constructed on the first quarter of the text, they group in a very different place from each other, whereas in this tree, they're actually very closely adjacent. So in fact, Ellesmere and Hengert had different exemplars for the first quarter of the text, but shared the same exemplar for the last, and indeed, one Ellesmere may well have been copied from Hengert. There are methods for mapping recombination points in DNA, so it was very interesting to see if we could use these methods for identifying where the scribe had changed their copy. And in particular, it's a method developed by John Maynard Smith, called the maximum chi-squared method for mapping recombination sites. And the way that works is summarized here. These two lines represent sequences, and if they're equally related all the way through, then the differences would be kind of scattered all the way through. That's shown by these crosses. Whereas if they're more closely related in one part, say the second part, then most of the differences will be clustered in the first part. And what this method does is that it takes a point and moves it along these sequences, and it compares the distribution of differences on each side of that point that we observe with the distribution of differences that we would expect if they're equally closely related. And it calculates a chi-squared value for the deviation of the observed from the expected. And when the arrow is at the point where the recombination took place, we then expect a maximum value of chi-squared. So if we apply this maximum chi-squared analysis to these sets of manuscripts like Ellesmere and Hengert, then what do we get? We get something like this. It works extremely well. This is a graph showing the chi-squared values as you move down the manuscript. And what you find is that there is a peak in the chi-squared, and one can calculate the statistical significance of these values. There is a peak in the chi-squared that corresponds to line 404 in the manuscript, indicating that that's the point where the scribe changed over text. And it was very encouraging to go through the work by the scholars earlier in the 20th century, Menley and Rickert, who had identified this point, or identified the fact that there was this shift in exemplar, and using their traditional scholarship, they picked out line 400 as being the point where the scribe changed. So remarkably close similarity to what we observed. So that was extremely encouraging. We've been applying this kind of approach to a series of other texts, and we don't have time for me to go through all the texts that we've looked at. I'll just tell you a little bit about one other set of texts that we've looked at quite recently. This is a poem called the Mahabharata, which is a major Sanskrit text coming from India, ascribed to a mythological sage who was known as the compiler or the arranger. Basically, it describes a huge power struggle between two cousins and their families who are fighting for the rights to the kingdom. It's a huge poem, 100,000 stanzas in 18 books, 1,200 chapters, and is divided, the scholars think, into two main divisions, a northern division and a southern division. And this is work that we've done with Wendy Phillips Rodriguez here in Cambridge in the Oriental Studies Department. And the traditional view is that these northern versions shown up here can be regarded as falling into two groups, a kind of Kashmir-based group of texts and a northeastern group of texts separate from the southern group of texts. So we used data that we got from Wendy. We didn't have data for the entire set of the text, because I told you it's an extremely long text indeed. But what we did was to have data from kind of selected points picked as you go throughout the text. This is a neighbor net analysis of the complete data. And again, very satisfyingly, without prior knowledge on our part, it picks out very robustly the difference between the southern manuscripts at the top and the northern groups of manuscripts, which are shown down here. And indeed, that division that the scholars have proposed between the northeastern and the northwestern manuscripts is borne out quite well in that analysis there. There's the Kashmiri group, and these are all the northeastern groups of manuscripts. We're interested to see if we could find examples, again, of a scribe changing their exemplar. And we found a very interesting situation. And the ones to look at are D6 here and DN1, which, if you look at the first section, are quite closely related in that tree. If you go on to the second section, I'm sorry, they kind of jump around a bit, but D6 and DN1 are still quite closely related. But if you go on to the third section, then D6 has moved and is now closely related to a group that has this manuscript in called D5 and is no longer particularly closely related to DN1. So that suggested to us that, again, there was a shift of exemplar. And we put it through the maximum chi-squared analysis. This is a comparison of D6 and D5, and you get a peak here at that point with a very strong probability value. This graph shows you whether manuscripts are more similar and getting different, or vice versa. So the higher up we are here, the more different the manuscripts are. So that tells you that D6 and D5 are initially quite different, and then at about that character become much more similar. And if you do the complementary comparison, D6 and DN1, then around very much the same point, here's the chi-squared graph again, we get indications of a transition, and we can see that they're becoming more different after that point. So what that shows us is that we had a predicted breakpoint in this comparison at about character number 3735, and in this comparison at about 3757. So we're actually extremely close together, given the very large number of characters that we're looking at. And this corresponds to the end of chapter 51, and this is the beginning of chapter 59. We didn't have the intervening chapters, but this is actually quite an important position in the book, because it's the beginning of chapter 59 is a key part of the narrative, and these two protagonists start a match throwing dice with each other to decide who's going to win the kingdom and so on. And they bet their brothers, they bet their wives, and eventually they bet their kingdoms. So this is a very important part of the book, and one can imagine that a scribe who is making a copy would be very concerned around this region to make sure that, that he or she was using the very best bit of the text to make that copy. So phylogenetic methods do give us a very powerful tool for studying the copying history of manuscripts, and the conclusions are very consistent with those that are reached by conventional scholarship. And I would stress that this is a tool that one can offer the scholars to help them. One isn't trying to say that this is something to replace conventional scholarship. And we can deal to some extent with these situations where scribes use more than one version in making their copy. Just very briefly, I'll mention the fact that we can use genetic techniques not only to study the text that's written on the manuscript, but we can use them to study the actual manuscript itself, the physical item, because manuscript is written on parchment, and parchment is basically just dried animal skin. It's not tanned or anything like that. The way it was made, you can see in this illumination, was by stretching the skin out over a frame and then scraping it with this very sharp knife and slowly getting a thinner sheet of parchment until it dried out completely and is very thin. So if we could get DNA from this parchment, then we could start to answer some quite interesting questions, like what species was used to make a manuscript. Now, sometimes that's fairly obvious. You don't have to be an expert paleographer to know that something like this, for example, probably didn't come from a rabbit, unless they had very, very large rabbits. But very often there are more subtle distinctions that one might want to make. Equally, you might be able to, if you can get within species comparisons, then you can start to ask some quite subtle questions about the provenance of manuscripts. If you have a manuscript whose provenance you don't know, but can show that it's on parchment that's genetically indistinguishable from a manuscript you do know about, that may give you a clue as to where your first manuscript came from. And that may give us insights also into medieval husbandry techniques. And we started doing some work on this, and we've from not particularly old manuscripts as yet, but we managed to get hold of mitochondrial DNA, as shown there. We've also managed to get some nuclear microsatellite markers, which is quite exciting because we can distinguish different microsatellite markers in some sets of parchment. So that's a very exciting development. We do need to develop non-destructive methods, because you can imagine that librarians who have precious manuscripts in their collections get a bit nervous if you turn up kind of with a pair of scissors looking shifty. So that's something that we need to develop. But I think in principle there are a lot of very exciting applications in that area. So I should end by acknowledging these people, particularly on the textual analysis side, Heather Windrum and Matt Spencer, who's now in Liverpool, and our paleographer colleagues, Peter Robinson, Barbara Bordalejo, and Lynn Mooney. And on the parchment DNA side of it, Mim Bauer in the archaeology department here, and Christopher de Hamel, who's a librarian at Corpus Christi College, where you're having your dinner on Thursday, I think. And funding from these people who've been very broad-minded about funding this slightly eccentric kind of work. Thank you very much.
Questions? How come all the manuscripts come out as leaves of your tree?
I think that's because well, for two reasons. One is that's where the programs put them, and the other reason is that actually one has only a relatively small sample of manuscripts left, so many have been destroyed. And one of the things that is interesting is to try to understand better how manuscripts that are, in effect, living ancestors of manuscripts that we also have, how they behave in phylogenetic tree building. We've done one simulation, and we're doing another one at the moment, where you get a bunch of present-day people to copy a text, so you know the copying history, and then you do the phylogenetic analysis of that. So we're trying to understand there, where we know we have some manuscripts that are the direct ancestors of existing ones. We're trying to understand from that how they behave in the tree. And what generally seems to happen is they go on a very kind of, you know, short branch. So we're starting to understand how they behave. then who's next?
There was that paper a couple of years ago where people looked at those chain letters that went around in the 70s and 80s that we all got and sent onwards, and they were using compression techniques to compare. Did you ever look at those?
We've not used those. There are people I know in Italy who've been using those, and they actually seem to work really quite well. It's not a branch that we've been involved in ourselves, but it's interesting one to look at.
Do you ever have problems with alignment? So if it's grammar changes with poetry, I can imagine that some alignment might be ambiguous.
Yeah, the alignment isn't entirely straightforward. I mean, I guess that's the case with sequence data as well. And one of the things that is striking is the number of similarities between dealing with textual data and dealing with sequence data. So, I mean, questions like deletions. What you often find is that if you have the same word at the end of two lines, then the scribe will jump, having written the first line, will jump to the end of the second line and miss out a line, which is has very close parallels in DNA replication, slippage, deletions, and so on. So again, you need to be careful about questions of whether you score that as a single deletion or whether it's multiple deletions, because clearly it was almost certainly just a single event. So exactly as with sequence alignments, one needs to think carefully about how you're going about the alignment, and there are some bits that are difficult to handle.
Do scribes working in different languages employ different levels of recombination?
That's a very interesting question. A lot of the texts that one is dealing with, probably the scribes didn't actually understand. They were just kind of copying blindly. And we've been doing some work on Dante's Monarchia. And there are a lot of complicated names in those, and the scribes went completely haywire with those names. So depending on what they're copying, there are certainly different degrees of accuracy, I think.
Yeah, this was a little related to the alignment question. Given that you had such variation in spelling, capitalization, punctuation, all that, then to what extent is that actually playing a part? Are you ignoring those differences, or are you trying to track those?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It depends on the text that you're dealing with. So with texts like the Canterbury Tales, we, for example, ignored spelling variants. And the reason for that was that at that time, there was a lot of flexibility in spelling. And so one scribe might have their own rules. So actually, they might change the spelling throughout the text. Also, dialect words may be significant as well. So a scribe working in Scotland may change church to kirk, for example. So one needs to be careful about those kinds of change.
Two questions. Do you know what happened to the gospel project in Münster? One gospel, I think, had more than 400 manuscripts or something like that.
We've done some work. Matt Spencer at the back did a lot of work on that. It's an extremely complicated tradition to deal with, because there's such a huge number of texts, and the kind of pattern very early on is extremely, and you can't resolve anything. Whether that is indicative of a period of oral transmission that then kind of coalesced into different lineages, I don't know. But that's a phenomenally difficult tradition to handle.
And second question, is there any kind of this work done with Chinese manuscripts? They don't have our letter system. But still, they copy each other's work. So
I'm not aware of it. I have started talking to some Chinese speakers to see if one could try to devise some kind of system for codifying the changes. And I think that kind of thing would be very interesting. We're also interested in trying to look at musical traditions as well, because there are many instances where you would have a tune that was copied by different groups and the tune changed, for example. Again, encoding that is potentially difficult. There isn't such a clear model of change by substitution and so on as we have in these Western texts. But it would be fascinating to do that, certainly.
I also have a question in the is there anybody actually working on developing programs, especially made for reconstructing the history of texts? Because using the DNA programs, I mean, that is actually what causes the problem of having everything put to the leaves, right? Because that is, we assume evolution is continuous and still ongoing, so we wouldn't have any species preserved that is very old, but we might have text preserved that is very old. So it's what, like, to me, it would seem logical that you need special programs to deal with your problem.
Yes, I mean, if somebody would do that, that would be very, very useful. We have a volunteer.
But a split decomposition method, for example, it can put leaves, it can put text where it wants. There's nothing inside the method that's stopping it from putting them in on the internal nodes.
Mm-hmm.
It's
not like what the same for neighbor joining. I mean, if it's an X tree, it will just make you the nodes inside.
What seems to happen, and to be honest, I haven't had a chance to go back and work out exactly what's going on, but what seems to happen in cases like that is that it puts the text on a very, very short edge. So if we know that that's how it behaves, then that kind of tells us where we see that pattern in the tree, that's almost certainly what's going on.
Yeah, well, that's always going to happen, is it? Because whoever's copying something is going to make mistakes of his own that are going to cause that short edge.
I mean, I think this is where kind of artificial copying traditions can be quite useful, where we know exactly what the copying history is. That's quite helpful. And Matt Spencer and others did a study a few years ago now using one of those traditions, and that was quite enlightening in helping us to understand what was going on.
In his thesis, he studied the skip stark's marlin or something. These are manuscripts that are copied.
Right.
But each copy says exactly where it has been copied from.
Yeah.
So you have the exact history, and you can try to reconstruct.
We're trying to get hold of Peter's data so that we can use these programs on that. So when he finds it again, we can use it.
But is there an equivalent of the molecular clock or something along those lines in manuscripts? So you could maybe order them in time and predict when ancestral manuscripts were written?
I guess in terms of kind of conventional phylogenetic analysis, I've always been very wary of assuming clocks. So I've steered clear of anything in the manuscript phylogeny side that involves clock assumptions. We get enough stick from the paleographers as it is that I'd rather not make additional assumptions. But I mean, it would be interesting to try doing that. And there are clearly some scribes who are not good, and so you have some long branches.
It looks like a viral measurably evolved population at different times in the manuscripts.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to try.
But for clock things, wouldn't you need to have them be copied on a regular basis? Did that happen? I mean, did they write every 10 years and produce a new copy? Or
No. I mean, in some cases, there are historical data to give you an idea of when a particular version was made and so how many versions have been made over a period of time. But I think calibrating it would be difficult.
Is Mooney with 3-0 a copying mistake?
Oh, I beg your pardon, yes. Indeed, that's Lynn Mooney with 2-0s, not 3-0s. Well spotted. I was waiting for somebody to spot that. That was very good. Thank you.
So I guess these are all unrooted trees that you're trying to reconstruct, but I mean, from a sort of historical point of view, the time ordering would be, I think, of interest. Yet, I think at the moment you do that, you immediately get into an area which really is outside of the kinds of methods that have been developed for biological copies. Because you could have the possibility where you have a document which perhaps serves over 150 years as being copied by different generations of monks or whatever. a single document could sort of exist over a period of time rather than existing at a point.
I think that illustrates the point very well, that in using these kinds of methods, one needs to work very closely with the manuscript scholars. So this is one tool that they can use, but they will need to bring other insights to the study. So they may well have historical information about particular manuscripts. They may know where they came from. They may, in the case of the Hengut manuscript, there are comments in the Hengut manuscript that indicate that he was working directly with Chaucer, and indeed was functioning around the time of Chaucer's death. So you know, one has to bring those kinds of insights into here. What I think we're doing here is basically giving the manuscript scholars a tool that says you can very quickly answer the question, does this bit of the text have the same copying history as that bit of the text, and so on.
Okay, well, let's thank Chris and all the speakers from this afternoon.